Imagine stepping out of your front door today, like right now in the year 2026, and realizing you're walking straight through the middle of a massive invisible war.
Yeah, and it's a war that most people don't even see happening.
Exactly. I mean, there are no troops on the ground. There are no territories changing hands on a map or anything. But the stakes are literally the future of how humanity interacts with machines.
Which is wild to think about.
It really is.
Yeah.
And, you know, usually when we think of global tech dominance, we picture this race to build like the fastest microchip, or we see that viral video of a humanoid robot doing a backflip.
Right, the Boston Dynamics stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And it's so easy to just look at the hardware and think, oh, whoever builds the coolest machine is winning the race. But the reality of tech hegemony has completely shifted.
Right.
It's no longer just about who builds the physical hardware.
Not at all. It is entirely about who writes the underlying rules that the hardware is legally required to follow.
Yeah.
Because the battleground has basically moved from the engineering lab to the bureaucratic standard setting room. I mean, if you can dictate the standard, the core language and like the legal requirements of an ecosystem, you control that entire ecosystem.
No matter whose logo is actually stamped on the physical robot.
Exactly. You own the whole board.
So today's deep dive into the source material is really about decoding that invisible war. We're going to examine how the US, China, and South Korea are locked in this deeply complex chess match over artificial intelligence and humanoid robotics.
And we have some really fascinating sources to pull from today.
We do. Now, just to set the stage for you listening, to do this, we are pulling from source text that details some pretty heavy ongoing geopolitical maneuvering. We're talking everything from specific Trump administration export controls in the U.S. to these highly coordinated state directives coming out of Beijing.
It gets pretty intense.
It does. And I want to make it clear right up front. We're going to impartially explore these policies and the raw facts exactly as they are presented in the material. The goal here isn't to take a political stance, you know, or pick sides between Washington and Beijing.
Right, we're just looking at the mechanics.
Exactly. We just want to look objectively at the mechanics of these strategies so you can actually understand the tectonic shifts that are happening right under our feet.
So to map out where we're going today, we really need to start by looking inside a pivotal room in Beijing, where the DNA for future robotics was basically drafted.
Sounds like a movie.
It kind of plays out like one. And from there, we have to look at why those decisions pose such a severe structural threat to South Korea's massive pre-existing robotics industry.
Which is a huge part of this story.
It is. And finally, we need to dissect this really fascinating policy paradox, looking at how aggressive tech sanctions from the U.S., which were designed to choke off Chinese AI development, actually acted as a massive accelerant for their domestic industry.
Oh, that part is so crazy. So let's just go straight to that room in Beijing. The date is February 28, 2026. You have over 120 different entities gathered under this massive state-backed committee.
The HEIS, right. Codename TCA.
Yeah, TCA. And the room is just packed with the absolute heavyweight of the Chinese robotics sector. We're talking companies like Unitree, Agibot, Ubitech, and Galbit.
All the major players.
All of them. But they didn't gather to show off a new physical prototype or, you know, have a tech demo. They gathered to unveil a highly technical, super bureaucratic document. It's titled The Humanoid Robot and Embodied AI Standard System, 2026 edition.
What's fascinating here is that the underlying strategy of releasing a document like that is deeply rooted in the mechanics of technology hegemony.
How so?
Well, if you study how nations dominate a specific technology, there is a very clear three-tiered progression.
Okay, lay it out for us.
The first tier is just inventing or mastering the core technology itself, getting it to work. Then the second tier is dominating mass production.
So scaling it up.
Right, scaling it up so you control the sheer volume of the global market. And according to the data in our sources, China effectively locked down those first two tiers by 2025.
Wow, already.
Yeah, they hold an overwhelming majority of the global humanoid robot market. We're talking 78 to 85% of the market, with over 150 companies churning out like 330 different models.
That is just a staggering amount of hardware. Which means they are ready for the third tier.
Exactly. The third and final tier is writing the rules. by launching this state-defined standard, which actually officially takes effect on July 1st, 2026, they're establishing the toll booth.
The toll booth, I like that.
Yeah, because when you write the rule book, you have the power to block non-compliant products from crossing your borders, and you force foreign innovators to pay licensing fees just to interact with your ecosystem.
Okay, let's unpack this standard document, because I want to look at the actual anatomy of it. It's hyper-specific.
It really is.
The standard is broken into six distinct parts. It covers basic terminology, reliability testing, and sector-specific performance. You know, like how a robot operates in a logistics center versus a hospital.
Which makes sense. You need those benchmarks.
Right. But the parts that seem to carry the real weight are the physical specs, the specs for the VLA models, the vision language action brains, and then this big section on safety and ethics.
Yeah, those are the crucial ones.
Let's start with the physical stuff. Why are they defining the exact physical specifications for robotic hands and actuators?
Because that dictates the entire supply chain. I mean, think about an actuator or a harmonic reducer.
Right, the joints.
Yeah, it's essentially the complex gearbox or the cartilage that allows a robotic joint to move with real precision.
Okay.
If the Chinese standard dictates a highly specific communication protocol or, you know, a specific voltage requirement for those joints to talk to the robot's central processor.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Right. Then any manufacturer on Earth who wants to sell parts into the world's largest market has to retool their entire factory to meet that exact specification.
Wow. So it forces everyone else to play by their physical rules.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of stuck on the sixth part of the standard, the safety and ethics section.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Because the document explicitly mandates that the kill switch, the ultimate override authority over the machine, must remain in human hands. Which, okay, I understand the practical need for a kill switch. No one wants a sci-fi robot takeover.
It's exactly. Terminator rules.
Right. But why is the Chinese government rushing to legally encode robotic ethics into a global standard right now? Like, what's the rush?
It functions as a preemptive geopolitical shield.
A shield?
Yeah. By legally defining what constitutes ethical and safe AI behavior right now, Beijing is insulating its industry against future Western trade sanctions.
Oh, wow. That is clever.
It's extremely strategic, because if we look down the line, Western regulators might attempt to ban Chinese humanoid robots from their markets.
Right, citing security risks or something.
Exactly, citing ambiguous security risks or ethical concerns about AI autonomy. But China is setting up the chessboard so they can point to this globally established standard and argue, hey, our robots are perfectly compliant with the established ethical norms.
So it puts the West in this super awkward position of either accepting the robots or having to admit they're violating an international standard that they themselves failed to write.
Precisely. And we've actually seen this exact mechanism play out before.
Really? When?
Think about the global telecom infrastructure. During the transition from 3G to 4G to 5G and now 6G.
The Huawei situation.
Exactly. Companies like Huawei used their massive domestic market to solidify their internal technical standards. Then they systematically took those standards to international regulatory bodies like the ITU and 3GPP.
Right, and they just flooded them.
They submitted so much technical documentation that the Chinese domestic standard simply became the default global standard.
And then the patents, the licensing fees, the supply chain dominance.
Yeah.
It all just followed naturally.
Exactly. They're running the exact same playbook right now, but this time it's for embodied AI.
That is wild.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a written standard doesn't just enforce itself. Like, you can write all the rules you want in Beijing, but you need a mechanism to force a robotics company in Europe or North America to actually adopt them.
True.
So how do they enforce it then? I mean, if a European company builds a mechanically superior robot, why can't they just say, forget the standard, plug their robot in and let it learn on its own?
Because of the data mode.
The data mode.
Yeah. The sources detail this massive initiative centered around a concept that translates to real world, real training.
Real world, real training.
Okay. So China currently has over 10,000 humanoid robots deployed in actual physical environments, factories, warehouses, public spaces.
Just walking around doing stuff.
Exactly. And every single day, those physical machines are encountering obstacles, dropping items, correcting their balance, and sending petabytes of training data back to an open, centralized platform.
And this is run by the Beijing Innovation Center.
Yes. The platform is known as Tiangong.
So it's basically this massive physical crowdsourcing operation for robot brains.
It is. And it creates an inescapable gravity well. The control stack and the data formats required to access the Tiangong platform are all unified under this new 2026 standard.
Oh, I see.
Right. And this is the crucial mechanism. AI models require unimaginable amounts of real-world physical data to function properly.
You can't just program it in a vacuum.
Exactly. A European company could theoretically build a great physical robot, but to make it smart, they need data. If they refuse to adopt China's API and communication protocols, their robot is entirely locked out of the world's largest repository of physical training data.
It's like, okay, think about the software environment you rely on every day. The reason it's so incredibly frustrating to switch from, say, an iPhone to an Android device isn't because of the physical glass or the aluminum casing.
Right, the hardware is fine.
It's because the ecosystem, your apps, your communication protocols, your data, they're all locked into one specific language. By combining the physical standard with the Tiangong data platform, China is fundamentally trying to build like the iOS of the physical world,
That's a great way to put it. It
which
creates a massive structural vulnerability for countries that rely on building hardware without owning that underlying software ecosystem.
Right, and let's use South Korea to look at how that vulnerability plays out in real time. Because if you just look at the surface data, South Korea should be dominating this space.
Oh, absolutely.
They are the most highly automated country on the planet. I mean, the source material points out they have an astonishing 1,012 robots for every 10,000 human workers.
Which is huge.
It's huge. But the deeper you look into their supply chain, the more fragile the dominance appears. It sounds like South Korea is running this world-class restaurant, but they don't actually own the recipes or the ingredients.
The statistics in the material are actually quite stark on this. Despite their massive deployment of robots, South Korea's localization rate for core robotic components is severely lacking.
How bad is it?
They only produce about 43% of their core parts domestically.
Wow, less than half.
Yeah. For the reducers, those crucial joints we discussed earlier, they are dependent on Japan for roughly 76% of their supply.
Okay, so Japan makes the joints.
Right. And for the rare earth permanent magnets required to build the high efficiency motors, they are dependent on China for nearly 89%.
Oh, man. So they might be assembling the physical machines, but they are entirely dependent on their neighbors for the skeleton and the muscle.
Exactly.
But, I mean, parts can always be bought or sourced elsewhere, right? Even if it's more expensive. The real threat here seems to be the ecosystem lock-in we just talked about.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that is the core of what the sources call the shell assembler dilemma.
Shell.
Right. If the broader international community eventually capitulates and adopts China's VLA model inputs or their specific API protocols for robotic hands,
Then what happens to Korea?
South Korean AI startups and robotics manufacturers are going to hit a brick wall.
Yeah.
Their homegrown, cutting-edge software simply won't speak the dominant language. They will be forced to shoehorn their technology into a Chinese standard framework.
So if you are importing your physical joints from Japan, your magnetic motors from China, and formatting your entire software architecture to comply with a standard written in Beijing, you are no longer an innovator.
No, you're not.
You are literally just a shell assembler snapping foreign pieces together inside a foreign rule book.
Exactly. Now, the text does note a potential fix for this.
Oh, good, some help.
Well, temporary hope. South Korea could partner with the US and the EU to champion an open source operating system while aggressively gathering their own local data to secure a seat at the international standard setting table. But given the speed of the real-world, real training deployment in China, that feels like a desperate game of catch up.
Yeah, they are moving incredibly fast.
Yeah.
And that speed is the variable that caught a lot of analysts off guard. And it directly forces us to examine the policies coming out of Washington. Because, I mean, the U.S. government recognized this threat years ago.
They did.
I'm looking at the timeline of U.S. export controls, and the logic seems fundamentally sound on paper, at least. The strategy was labeled small yard, high fence.
Right, the small yard, high fence policy.
Yeah, so the U.S. identified advanced AI models as the absolute core of future economic and military power. The objective was to draw a tight boundary around only the most advanced critical technologies, that's the small yard, and build an impenetrable wall of export controls around it, the high fence.
Right.
And the primary mechanism for this was starving Chinese AI labs of the immense raw computational power they need to train those massive models.
Specifically, by cutting off access to cutting-edge AI accelerators like NVIDIA's H200 chips. And, you know, restricting access to top-tier Western software, like the ban in June 2026 on Anthropic's Fable 5 and Mythos 5 models.
Oh, yeah, the software bans too.
Yeah. The thesis was simple. You cannot build the smartest brain if you are denied the silicon neurons required to train it.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because the mechanics of how this policy backfired are just staggering.
It's a spectacular backfire.
It really is.
Yeah.
Because the Trump administration implemented these heavy restrictions, meticulously monitoring even, like, roundabout ways Chinese firms might acquire NVIDIA hardware.
Right.
But almost simultaneously, the Chinese government ordered its own domestic tech giants to immediately cease purchasing American chips. You had both Washington and Beijing enforcing the exact same blockade from opposite sides of the Pacific.
Which is wild.
So I have to ask, wait, by physically cutting off the hardware supply to an economy with that much capital, didn't the U.S. essentially force China to build its own kitchen?
Yes. That is the ultimate paradox of the high fence strategy. The U.S. embargo did not eliminate the demand for computing power in China. It simply created a captive, multi-billion dollar domestic market overnight.
Wow.
Think about it. Before the sanctions, Chinese tech conglomerates had no financial incentive to risk buying inferior domestic chips when NVIDIA was the gold standard.
Right. Why buy the knockoff when you can buy the best?
Exactly. But once NVIDIA was removed from the equation, they had no choice.
And the Chinese state heavily subsidized that forced transition,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, massively.
The National Development and Reform Commission ordered an unfathomable 2 trillion yuan, which translates to over 450 trillion Korean won, to be poured into national AI data centers over 5 years.
Just a massive influx of cash.
Yeah, and the condition for accessing that money was super strict. 80% of the hardware and software in those data centers had to be supplied by domestic companies.
Which meant NVIDIA and AMD were structurally locked out of the infrastructure build.
So what did that do to the market share?
The shift is pretty dramatic. Now, the sources advise caution with exact figures given the opacity of the market, but the trajectory is super clear.
Okay.
NVIDIA historically held a 90% monopoly over the Chinese AI accelerator market.
90%? That's huge.
Huge. But following these dual policies, that share collapsed to roughly 55%.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And in the resulting vacuum, domestic Chinese silicon just surged. Some reports place domestic market share at 41%, while others indicate it's already crossed the threshold to 52%.
So they might already have the majority, and Huawei is at the absolute center of this, aren't they?
They are the main player, yeah.
Because in March of 2026, they released their Ascend series accelerators.
Yeah.
And based on their internal benchmarks, these chips are actually outperforming NVIDIA's specific export-restricted model, the H20, in raw inference tasks. And they're doing it at a fraction of the cost.
Which is a huge deal. But, you know, building a fast chip is only half the battle. Hardware is useless without the software vocabulary to talk to it.
Right.
Historically, NVIDIA's real monopoly wasn't the silicon itself. It was CUDA.
CUD, I've heard of that. What is that exactly?
CUD is the foundational software layer that allows developers to actually instruct the NVIDIA hardware.
Right.
Over a decade, it became the default language of AI development.
Kind of like English for global business.
Exactly. And the switching costs for a company to rewrite all their AI models from CUA into a completely new language were historically considered too massive to even attempt. It was NVIDIA's ultimate defensive moat.
So how did Huawei break the moat? I mean, if everyone was speaking CUA, how did they get them to switch?
By removing the friction entirely. Huawei engineered an automated migration tool that essentially translates NVIDIA's CUDA code directly into their own proprietary ecosystem.
Wait, automatically?
Yes. They built a bridge that allowed massive Chinese tech conglomerates, companies like ByteDance, Tencent, and Alibaba, to port their existing AI infrastructure over to Huawei's Ascend processors and Cambricon chips with minimal disruption.
Oh, wow.
So the U.S. sanctions forced Chinese tech giants to become self-reliant, and that self-reliance catalyzed the creation of a massive, fully integrated competitor.
I mean, even NVIDIA's leadership acknowledged the unintended consequences. Jensen Huang himself noted that the U.S. effectively handed a massive domestic market over to Huawei.
Yeah, he saw it happening.
And we are seeing the exact same warnings regarding the software bans, like the restriction on the Anthropic models we talked about.
Mm.
Security analysts argue that blocking access to Western software just forces Chinese researchers to develop proprietary closed-loop systems,
right,
which ultimately just shrinks the footprint of the American tech ecosystem and isolates U.S. allies who rely on a unified global network.
This raises an important question, though, and we have to ground this conversation in the physical realities of manufacturing.
Okay, what do you mean?
Well, designing an advanced chip and writing the migration software is a remarkable achievement. It really is. But ultimately, you still have to physically print billions of microscopic transistors onto a piece of silicon.
Right, you still have to build the thing.
Exactly. And this is where China's rapid ascent hits a very real, very physical wall.
Ah, you are talking about the manufacturing bottleneck at SMIC China's premier semiconductor foundry.
Right.
Specifically regarding their 7-nanometer process.
Yes. Because the U.S. and its allies maintain a strict chokehold on EUV lithography machines.
The ones made by ASML in the Netherlands.
Exactly. These are ultra-complex, massive machines, and they are absolutely required to print the most advanced microscopic circuitry.
Right.
Because China cannot import these EUV machines, they have to use older, less precise lithography equipment to try and print these tiny 7-nanometer chips.
And I'm guessing that doesn't go very well.
It results in a crippling defect rate.
Mm.
They can successfully design a world-class AI accelerator, sure, but when SMIC tries to mass produce it, they end up throwing a massive percentage of the finished silicon in the trash.
Because the older machines just simply cannot maintain the required atomic precision.
Exactly.
The source text actually includes a quote from the analyst Dan Wang that frames this perfectly. He notes, "You can copy a blueprint, but you cannot copy the feeling of hands that have carved something tens of thousands of times."
I love that quote. That is the essence of process knowledge.
Process knowledge.
Yeah, you can reverse engineer a robot, and you can write a software migration tool. But the institutional muscle memory required to operate a semiconductor fabrication plant at peak efficiency, minimizing defects at the atomic scale.
You can't just download that.
No, it's not something you can learn from a manual. It requires years of trial, error, and physical repetition. Process knowledge is the one domain where the high fence strategy is actually holding up.
Which brings us back to South Korea and the complex reality of their current economic position. Because if you look at South Korean memory chip makers right now, they are experiencing a massive economic boom.
Huge profits.
Record-breaking. Because China is pouring trillions of yuan into building out these domestic data centers to escape the U.S. sanctions, and they are consuming unbelievable quantities of DRAM.
Right.
It is draining the global supply, driving prices up, and South Korean tech firms are just raking it in.
But if you understand the underlying mechanics of what China is trying to build, that boom reveals itself to be highly temporary.
So what does this all mean?
Well, the boom is a mirage.
A mirage, okay.
Yeah. To understand why, we have to look at high bandwidth memory, or HBM. Standard memory chips are fine for smartphones, but AI models require data to move at lightning speed between the memory and the processor.
Right, because there's so much data.
Exactly. HBM is essentially a multi-lane superhighway built directly on top of the processor to handle that massive data load. And according to the text, South Korea is currently manufacturing sixth generation HBM4.
Which is top of the line.
It is. They hold a technological lead over China of about 2 to 3 years.
That's the hypergap they talk about.
Right, the hypergap. But China is aggressively moving to close that specific gap. Their leading memory manufacturer, CXMT, is injecting over 1 trillion won into establishing their own mass production of high bandwidth memory, specifically HBM3, targeting late 2026.
Late 2026. That's right around the corner. If CXMT succeeds in producing viable HBM3 memory, and they successfully integrate that memory superhighway with Huawei's Ascend processors, the entire geopolitical equation changes.
Absolutely.
China will have achieved absolute top-to-bottom self-sufficiency. They will be entirely capable of designing, printing, and powering the brains of their AI models and humanoid robots completely in-house.
They won't need anyone else.
Right? They won't need South Korean memory or American processing design.
Mm-hmm.
The record profits South Korea is currently enjoying would just evaporate because they'd find themselves locked out of the ecosystem entirely.
Yeah.
That 2 to 3 year hypergap is the only thing keeping the current order intact, and the clock is ticking loudly.
The entire timeline is dictated by the durability of those bureaucratic fences. I mean, if the U.S. manages to tighten the sanctions on older semiconductor equipment, they might stall SemSmith's manufacturing process and widen that gap.
Right.
But if China's domestic ecosystem achieves that process knowledge faster than anticipated, the window for South Korea and the West to maintain leverage could slam shut almost overnight.
Wow. The mechanics of this invisible war are just staggering when you lay them all out like this.
It's a lot to take in.
It is. I mean, we started by looking at a sterile bureaucratic meeting in Beijing that was quietly drafting the legal API formatting for the future of humanoid robotics.
Yeah.
And we mapped out how that standard, combined with the gravitational pull of the Tiangong real-world data platform, threatens to turn highly advanced robotics nations like South Korea into mere shell assemblers. And then we dissected the deep irony of how the U.S. attempt to starve China of AI computing power inadvertently catalyzed the creation of a massive, fully integrated Chinese silicon ecosystem, dismantled the CUDA software monopoly, and ignited a race to close the final gaps in semiconductor manufacturing.
It fundamentally changes how you have to look at the technology ecosystem. The interconnected devices, the autonomous software, and the intelligent robotics that will integrate into daily life over the next decade. They will not be shaped entirely by pure engineering or free market innovation.
Yeah, they won't.
They are going to be strictly defined by API bottlenecks, state-mandated ethics protocols, and the sprawling unintended consequences of international trade blockades.
It leaves you with a deeply complex question about where this all ends. If geopolitical borders today are no longer drawn on maps, but are instead being defined by API formatting, hardware standards, and state-mandated safety ethics, what happens when these vast, embodied AI systems inevitably reach the capability to analyze their own performance? When the machine intelligence advances to the point where it begins rewriting its own underlying code and optimizing its own operating procedures without human input.
That's the real question.
Will Washington and Beijing still be locked in a bitter dispute over who holds the physical rulebook? Or will the technology have simply outgrown the concept of rules entirely?
It's a lot to think about.
It definitely is. Something for you to mull over as we watch this all unfold. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the source material. We will see you next time.